Now, wisdom and compassion, this is also referred to as eros and agape.
Yes, ascending eros and descending agape, transcendence and immanence, the love that reaches up and the love that reaches down. The central historical point in all of this is that with the great non-dual systems from Plotinus in the West to Nagarjuna in the East, we see an emphasis on balancing and integrating these two movements. The ascending or transcendental current of wisdom or eros or prajna is to be balanced with a descending or immanent current of compassion or agape or karuna. And the union of these two, the union of the one and the many, of emptiness and form, of wisdom and compassion, their union in the non-dual heart of one taste is the source and goal and ground of genuine spirituality.
So this is the non-dual in its dualistic guises. This is God and Goddess, as eros and agape, wisdom and compassion, ascent and descent.
Yes, in a broad sense. If we ignore for the moment the more provincial and stage-specific notions of the horticultural Great Mother as a farming protectress and the agrarian images of God the Father as a big daddy in the sky, these mythic images are not very useful for an overall picture. And if we look instead to the broad understanding of God and Goddess, then the balanced picture that emerges is something like this. If we wish to think in such terms, then the masculine face of spirit, or God, is preeminently Eros, the ascending and transcendental current of the cosmos, ever striving to find greater wholeness and wider unions, to break the limits and reach for the sky, to rise to unending revelations of a greater good and glory, always rejecting the shallower in search of the deeper, rejecting the lower in search of the higher. And the feminine face of spirit, the goddess, is preeminently agape, or compassion, the descending and immanent and manifesting current of the cosmos, the principle of embodiment and bodily incarnation and relationship, and relational and manifest embrace, touching each and every being with perfect and equal grace, rejecting nothing, embracing all. Where Eros strives for the good of the one in transcendental wisdom, agape embraces the many with goodness and immanent care.
And you tie this in with Tantra.
Yes, Tantra, in the general sense, presents the ultimate non-dual reality as the sexual embrace of God and the goddess, of Shiva and Shakti, of emptiness and form. Neither ascent nor descent is final, ultimate, or privileged, but rather, like the primordial yin and yang, they generate each other, depend upon each other, cannot exist without the other, and find their own true being by dying into the other, only to awaken together, joined in bliss as the entire cosmos, finding that eternity is wildly in love with the productions of time, the non-dual heart radiating as all creation and blessing all creation, and singing this embrace for all eternity, an embrace that we are all asked to repeat in our own awareness, moment to moment, endlessly, miraculously, as the immediate presence of one taste. This is the non-dual vision, this union of reflux and efflux, God and the goddess, emptiness and form, wisdom and compassion, eros and agape, ascent and descent, perfectly and blissfully united in one taste, the radical sound of one hand clapping.
And this is likewise the non-dual integrative vision of Plotinus.
Yes, that's right. But this union of ascent and descent would, in subsequent Western history, be often broken, with the otherworldly ascenders and the thisworldly descenders in constant and sometimes violent conflict. This subsequent war has been one of the central and defining conflicts in the Western mind.
This war between the ascenders and the descenders.
Oh yes, it's quite remarkable. Beginning with Augustine and continuing right down to today, the ascenders and the descenders were in relentless and often brutal conflict, and this saddled the West with two completely incompatible gods, as it were. The God of the ascenders was otherworldly to the core. My kingdom is not of this world. It was puritanical, usually monastic and ascetic, and it saw the body, the flesh, and especially sex, as archetypal sins. It sought always to flee the many and find the one. It was purely transcendental, and was always pessimistic about finding happiness in this world. It shunned time in favor of eternity, and hid its face in shame from the shadows of this world. The god of the descenders counseled exactly the opposite. It fled from the one into the embrace of the many. It was in love with the visible, sensible god, and sometimes goddess. It was a god of pure embodiment, of pure immanence. It was fascinated with diversity and found its glory in the celebration of this diversity. Not greater oneness, but greater variety was the goal of this god. It celebrated the senses and the body and sexuality and earth, and delighted in a creation-centered spirituality that saw each sunrise, each moonrise, as the visible blessing of the divine.
In Sex Ecology and Spirituality, you trace the history of this war between the two gods.
Yes, that's right. In the West, during the millennium between Augustine and Copernicus, we see an almost exclusively ascending ideal. Indeed, since this was an agrarian structure, there was a selection for male-biased spirituality, which consequently centered on eros more than agape, on ascent more than descent, on the one to the exclusion of, even hatred of, the many. And thus, true salvation, true liberation, could not be found in this body, on this earth, in this lifetime. It was otherworldly to the core. Flesh is sin, and sex is sin, and earth is sin, and the body is sin, no matter what faint praise was given to creation itself. And so, of course, the root of sin was Eve in general, woman, body, flesh, nature, carnality. All of that becomes taboo in the deepest sense. Always, for the mere ascenders, descent is the devil.
In both the East and the West.
Definitely. There's a constant tendency in agrarian societies, wherever they appear, to let the ascending current pronounce this world evil or illusory, and to condemn earth, body, senses, sexuality, and woman. There were exceptions, of course, but this is the constant tendency in all agrarian structures. Otherworldly to the core, with my kingdom not of this world, and an intense desire to find a nirvana away from the world of samsara. You find this from early Judaism to virtually all forms of Gnosticism to early Buddhism and most forms of Christianity and Islam. And this was indeed the case in the West, especially, as I said, from the time of Augustine to the time of Copernicus. An almost exclusively ascending ideal dominated European consciousness for 1,000 years. The way up was the counsel that the Church gave for her perfections and her virtues, and lay not your treasures upon this earth was the one sure way to salvation, which means find nothing in or on this earth to be treasured. Oh, there was plenty of lip service given to the goodness of God's creation. Goodness, agape, compassion, descent. But the bottom line was that you could not gain liberation or salvation on this earth in this life, and therein lies the entire story. Life was okay, but things really got interesting once you died. Once, that is, you got off this earth. This earth was not a place where realization could be found. This earth was simply a runway for the real takeoff.
All of which soon changed, yeah?
Yes, all of which changed. And changed dramatically, with the Renaissance and the rise of modernity, culminating in the Enlightenment and the Age of Reason. And the simplest way to describe this entire period is that, at this point, the ascenders were out, the descenders were in. And for mere descenders, any form of ascent is always despised. Ascent, in fact, becomes the new evil. Ascent is forever the devil in the eyes of the descended god. So it's no surprise that from modernity forward, virtually any ascent of any variety became the new sin. The rise of modernity, the rejection of ascent, and the embrace of a purely descended world, these came into being together. And here we are, on the trail of the modern West's denial of the transpersonal dimensions. Here we start to see exactly the beginning of the dismissal or rejection or marginalization of the genuinely spiritual and transpersonal. Here we start to see the glorification of flatland, the embrace of the descended grid, the eclipse of any sort of transcendental wisdom, the eclipse of any sort of ascent, cast a shadow over the entire face of modernity. A shadow that is the signature of our times.
So what you're saying is that this flatland, this descended grid, has marked the entire modern and postmodern condition.
Oh, in many ways, yes. As a general statement, yes. Salvation in the modern world, whether offered by politics or science or revivals of earth religion or Marxism or industrialization or consumerism or retribalism or sexuality or horticultural revivals or scientific materialism or ecophilosophies. Salvation can be found only on this earth, only in the phenomena, only in manifestation, only in the world of form, only in pure immanence, only in the descended grid. There is no higher truth, no ascending current, nothing transcendental whatsoever. In fact, anything higher or transcendental is now the devil, is now the great enemy, is now the destroyer of the earthbound, sensory-drenched god and goddess. And all of modernity and postmodernity moves fundamentally and almost entirely within this descended grid, the grid of flatland.
Which is not the integration of ascent and descent.
No, this is simply the dominance of the descenders. And not just in official reality, but also in virtually every form of counterculture or counter-reality. The descended grid is so entrenched, so unconscious, so background, so deeply ingrained, that even the new paradigm rebels often move completely within its clutches. It infects equally orthodox and avant-garde, conventional and alternative, industrialist and ecologist.
So to conclude, the point is to integrate the ascending and descending currents in the human being.
That's right. The point is to bring these two currents into some sort of union and harmony, so that both wisdom and compassion can join hands in finding a spirit that both transcends and includes this world, a spirit eternally prior to this world, and yet embracing this world and all its beings with infinite love and compassion and care and concern and the tenderest of mercies and glory in the glance. And however much the flurry of descended religions help us to recognize and appreciate the visible, sensible god and goddess, nonetheless, taken in and by themselves, they place an infinite burden on Gaia that poor finite Gaia cannot sustain. It might be sustainable growth, but it is unsustainable spirituality, and we desperately need both. The ascending currents of the human being also have to be engaged and activated and cultivated. For it is only in being able to transcend our own limited and mortal egos that we can find that common source and ground of all sentient beings, a source that bestows new splendor on the setting sun and radiates grace in each and every gesture. Both the mere ascenders and the mere descenders, in tearing the cosmos into their favorite fragments, are contributing to the brutality of this warfare. But it is in the union of the ascending and the descending that harmony is found, and not in any brutal war between the two. Only when both are united, we might say, can both be saved. Which brings us directly to the integral vision itself, to some sort of holistic and integrated view. I've concentrated on an approach that attempts to honor and include the very best of pre-modernity, the great nest of being, the best of modernity, the differentiation of the big three, and the best of postmodernity, the integration of the big three, to arrive at a truly all-level, all-quadrant approach. Never before in history has this type of all-level, all-quadrant approach been possible, because never before were all the pieces of the puzzle available. Pre-modernity was all-level, but not all-quadrant. Modernity was all-quadrant, but not all-level. And that got even worse when the quadrants collapsed into flatland. Postmodernity, which set out to pick up the pieces and integrate the quadrants, instead fell into the intense gravitational field of flatland and ended up more fragmented than ever. But the pieces are all present, and what is now required is a vision capable of weaving them together in a genuinely holistic fashion. This is what all level, all quadrant attempts to do. And if this type of integral vision succeeds, it will have immediate applications in business, education, medicine, healthcare, politics, cultural studies, psychology, human development. The list is truly endless, it seems.
So essentially, people can begin to build such an integral vision themselves by applying the four quadrants to whatever field they're in.
That's right. Well, in medicine, for example, you can see that any effective care would have to take into account not just the objective medicine or physical treatment that you give the person, upper right quadrant, but also the person's subjective beliefs and expectations, upper left quadrant, the cultural attitudes, hopes, and fears about sickness, lower left quadrant. and the social institutions, economic factors, and access to health care, lower right quadrant, all of which have a causal effect on the course of a person's illness, because all four quadrants cause and are caused by the others. You can do the same analysis with law, education, business, politics, environmental ethics, schools of feminism, prison reform, philosophical systems, and so on. And this will pay off in the most concrete of ways. If the four quadrants are real, then any healthcare system that includes all of them will be more effective and therefore more cost-efficient. Any business that takes them into account will be more efficient and thus more profitable. Any educational system will be more effective, politics will be more responsive, spirituality will be more transformative, and so on.
So the second step of a more integral view is to move from all-quadrant to an all-level all-quadrant view.
That's right, which would trace out the various waves and streams of development in each of the quadrants. We've especially focused on development in the upper left quadrant, the nine or so fulcrums spanning the entire spectrum of consciousness, with their different needs, motivations, values, worldviews, self-identities, and so on, moving from matter to body to mind to soul to spirit. But those developments have correlates in all the other quadrants, and thus you can follow those as well. Not just what will medicine look like if it includes all four quadrants, but what will medicine look like if it also spans the entire spectrum of consciousness in each of the quadrants? Not just what can you do for healing if you use matter and body, but what can you do for healing if you use mind and soul and spirit as well? What would a full spectrum medicine look like? Likewise, what would a full spectrum education look like? Full spectrum economy, full spectrum politics, business, marriage, cinema, art. Following the full spectrum in each of the quadrants, the I and the we and the it domains all evolve from body to mind to soul to spirit. Thus, again, all quadrant, all level. And we might especially want to remember, when we include soul and spirit in an integral view, that we do so in both ascending and descending ways. We want to include the liberating movement of wisdom that takes us from body to mind to soul to spirit, but also the incarnational movement of compassion and healing that brings soul and spirit down and into body, earth, life, and relationship, both God and goddess equally honored. This also opens up an enormous number of possible research projects, and there are also all the small daily ways that you can implement your own integral vision as well. Such as, for example, personal transformation and spiritual practice. The final result is simply to awaken to who and what you timelessly are, to awaken to the spirit that is the actual author of this integral display. And there, hidden in the secret cave of the heart, where God and the goddess finally unite, where emptiness embraces all form as the lost and found beloved, where eternity joyously sings the praises of noble time, where Shiva uncontrollably swoons for luminescent Shakti, where ascending and descending erotically embrace in the sound of one hand clapping. There forever in the universe of one taste, the cosmos recognizes its own true nature, self-seen in a tacit recognition that leaves not even a single soul to tell the amazing tale. And remember, there in the heart, where the couple finally unite, the entire game is undone, this nightmare of evolution. And you're exactly where you were prior to the beginning of the whole show. With a sudden shock of the utterly obvious, you recognize your own original face, the face you had prior to the Big Bang, the face of utter emptiness that smiles as all creation and sings as the entire cosmos. And it is all undone in that primal glance, and all that is left is the smile and the reflection of the moon on a quiet pond late on a crystal clear night.
This concludes A Brief History of Everything by Ken Wilber. Read by Willow Pearson and Steve Grad. Music by Stephen McNamara. Produced by Sounds True. For a complete Sounds True catalog, please call 800-333-9185 or write P.O. Box 8010, Boulder,
Colorado 80306, or visit our website www.soundstrue.com. For a Shambhala book catalog, please call 866-424-0030, or visit the Shambhala website www.shambhala.com. Thank you for listening.